Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, the second day of October, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So, Avi, for generations, Americans have had this middle-class dream, you know, to own a car, own a home, have a couple kids, be able to send them to college if they want to go, maybe go on an annual family vacation, and be able to save for a decent retirement. This was something most people felt that if they did all the right things, they worked hard, that they could achieve. But these days, the stats show that the so-called class in the middle is actually getting smaller, and those living in it are feeling the squeeze. Home ownership is out of reach. College is so expensive. And financial stability, once the hallmark of the middle, is becoming harder to sustain. So today we're going to do a check-in on the middle class. We're going to look at the data. We're going to get some evidence of how the largest swath of Americans, those who are not rich and not poor, how they are doing. And we'll ask why the middle class is shrinking and what it all means for our economy. We have two great guests. But we really, really, really want to hear from you. What do you think it means to be middle class today? Is it about what you can afford, like home or college? Is it about financial stability? Or is it about something else? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And Avi, a lot of people who you think they've made it, they say, I don't feel like I've made it. I feel broke.
Who are these people?
People making, you know, quote, six figures.
Oh, yeah.
Doing what people used to think. You're doing well. They don't feel like they're doing well.
Yeah, consumer sentiment.
Yeah.
In the toilet.
In the toilet right now.
All right, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. It's also Thursday, so it's our DJ of the day, which means we'll end the show with a song picked by one of you. It has to be on the topic of today's show. Send your suggestions to studio2@whyy.org, and EP Kevin will pick the winner. We'll shout it out at the end of the show. Like I said, it could be about the middle. It could be about dreams, American dreams, money, stability,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera.
Working hard, all those things.
Working hard, but it can't be 9 to 5. Still can't be 9 to 5. Can never be 9 to 5.
That's on the banned list anytime we have a
it's
show
just so
about
strange, because 9 to 5 has never won. We've never even picked 9 to 5.
I know.
And it's a nice song.
It is.
And I love song. Dolly.
I do too. Who doesn't love Dolly?
It's not an anti-Dolly show. Anyways, DJ of the day, get those suggestions in by 12:30. First, a trio of local news stories.
Yep.
A federal agency wants SEPTA to remove over half of its regional rail train cars because of safety concerns. SEPTA is saying it's not going to do this, which means no service disruptions for now. But this is all a very stark reminder of the broader infrastructure woes plaguing the agency. Yeah. This latest news came yesterday when the National Transportation Safety Board recommended SEPTA remove cars from its Silver Liner 4 fleet. These cars date back to the 1970s. One of these old train cars caught fire in February, prompting the federal investigation. SEPTA says it's going to keep the cars in service with, quote, very intense inspection schedules. Even if it was going to try to replace these cars today, SEPTA says the process would take 5 to 7 years. And it's actually already in the process of trying to replace these really old regional rail cars.
Yeah, and all of this, of course, comes as SEPTA was forced to borrow hundreds of millions of dollars from the very fund that would be used to fund capital projects like replacing these trains, and they had to use that money to pay for operating costs. So it just underscores the financial crisis that SEPTA is currently facing. And for me, I think, you know, the lawyers are waiting on the sidelines, you know, because now that this report is out, if something happens and people are in danger or injured, you know, it's going to be lawsuits, you know, even more problems for SEPTA. And I mean, if you're a rider, you might be even a little more nervous. But yeah. I mean, SEPTA is juggling so many things at the same time.
Oldest rail fleet in the nation.
Wow.
In some ways, it's miraculous they keep these things on the track.
Yeah.
That there aren't more problems, right? So you have to, in some ways, tip your hat to the folks on the ground who make all of that happen. But obviously, it's a canary in the coal mine. It shows you what SEPTA is facing, the fact that these cars are still running.
Yeah.
And they were like put on the rails, I think, in the Carter administration.
I know. And it takes so long to make replacements. So, yeah.
Story number two.
Number two.
Penn University of Pennsylvania is getting more attention from the Trump administration. The Wall Street Journal reports Penn is one of nine schools that received letters recently from the Department of Education asking them to sign, quote, compacts to get priority for federal research dollars. What's in these compacts? I'm guessing you would ask. Well, these would require the schools like Penn to freeze tuition for 5 years, cap international student enrollment, commit to strict definitions of gender, ban use of race or sex in hiring, and abolish departments that, quote, punish, belittle, and even spark violence against conservatives' ideas. As a reward for adherence to this compact, if Penn were to sign it, they would get crucial flexibility in how federal research dollars are used and priority for future funding.
Yeah, sort of like rewarding them for capitulating to the demands of the Trump administration. I mean, and Penn, of course, has been one of the elite schools that capitulated to demands with what it appeared to be little fight, right, in order to keep their federal dollars. And so it seems like, hey, maybe the administration assumed that they would be open to an idea of getting,
that.
You know, this priority on, you
I
know.
I mean, they said, look, Penn bent the knee.
Hey.
Why don't you bend a little further? And I mean, that's really all it is.
But one thing that troubled me is the agreement's potential impact on free speech on campus. I mean, the compact asked universities to ensure a, quote, vibrant marketplace of ideas on campus and to bar employees from expressing political views on behalf of their employer unless the matter affects the school. And it feels like, you know, government overreach in the speech on campus. And I mean, just so many red flags, so many red flags. And I wonder if Penn will bend even more.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could say, look, this you mentioned that Penn has already capitulated on some things. And most recently, it was they decided to basically erase Leah Thomas's name from the school record books, basically pretend she never went to Penn or swam there, and they got some federal money unfrozen. But it goes back even further before the Trump administration. Frankly, you know, the president was forced to step down. The board chair resigned. Again, pre-Trump, Penn cleared student encampments. I mean, it's sort of one thing after another, and it doesn't seem like Penn gets any further. You know, they don't get any more independence. They don't get any more autonomy for all of these concessions. So at what point does Penn say no more concessions?
We haven't reached the line.
We haven't reached the line. We clearly haven't. We clearly haven't. And look, all these institutions at some point are going to have to make a decision. Do we prioritize some principles that we stand for, or do we exist to perpetuate ourselves?
Yeah.
Because they've chosen the latter time and time again.
Yeah.
At what point would they choose the former?
And at some point you got to stand up. So at some point you got to draw the line. And then the question is, Penn, where is the line?
Where is the line? Where is the great classic TV show of my youth.
And by the way, this is some positive
story number three.
News. Yes, because to all my 80s and 90s babies who are now raising babies, listen up. After 20 years off air, Reading Rainbow is back. Yay. Originally hosted by the one and only LeVar Burton, Reading Rainbow ran on PBS from 1983 to 2006 and encouraged kids like me to fall in love with books. And now LeVar Burton will not be back, by the way. Instead, the show has a new host, TikTok star Michael Thweets. He is a librarian and literacy advocate, and he made the announcement about the return of the show on social media this week. Take a look, a brief look at the little trailer.
I'm Michael the Librarian, and this place is the library. Reading Rainbow is returning with all new episodes. Ready?
Yes!
Yay! New episodes of the show will be released via the YouTube channel Kidzooku, by the way. And fans of the show and of Thweets are really excited. They said only he could take over after Burton. And there will be a lot of special guests, including John Legend, Chrissy Teigen, Adam Levine, all reading books.
Adam Devine.
Sorry.
Not Adam Levine. Maybe he'll come on
Devine.
A future episode.
Adam Devine. I apologize. But yeah, I mean, and so, you know, great show. And if you were to think about it, Avi, what PBS kids show would you bring back?
I thought a lot about this, Cherry. It's a great question. You know, I thought maybe Bill Nye the Science Guy at first.
Mm-hmm.
Because science could use a win.
Science needs a win.
I thought about Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
That's a good
thought one. Thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraging international travel inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Cross-cultural interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Thought about Thought about Barney even.
I love you.
Yeah.
You love me.
Great message.
I love it. We need some love in this world.
But I ultimately landed on a show kind of similar to Reading Rainbow.
Which is?
A show to encourage literacy that's aimed at those kids a little older that are getting sucked into these social media algorithms. We need to get those kids unsucked. And I went with Wishbone. You remember Wishbone?
I don't remember Wishbone.
What?
Oh my God. Did
I miss
this? You
don't remember Wishbone?
I don't remember
Wishbone. It was this little dog, and he would daydream about being like a character in these literary classics. You don't remember Wishbone?
I don't remember Wishbone.
Well, now we definitely got to bring it back.
Oh my goodness.
What's the story
of
Wishbone?
Did I just totally miss this?
Yeah, he would be like, they would do like a Mark Twain book or a Shakespeare, and Wishbone would be like, the dog would be the main character, and the dog would act. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you can write your angry emails for her not knowing about Wishbone.
Oh my
God. Studio 2 at WHYY.
I was a Reading Rainbow, and my brother loved Barney. So, like my baby brother, so we watched a lot of
Barney. Lamb Chops Play Along. Bring that one back too. By the
way. Lamb chop is good. Yeah.
Anyways.
We're talking about the middle class coming up.
It's been chopped down.
Yeah. Right after the break.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Is the middle class shrinking? The simplest answer to the question is yes. There are fewer Americans in the fat middle part of the income distribution than there were 50 years ago. But when you pose the question in a different way, things get more complicated.
For example, the Washington Post recently asked Americans what they consider markers of a middle class life. And then they looked at how likely Americans were to attain those markers. Over time, they actually found the percentages hadn't moved all that much.
The middle class is somewhere between a reality and a vibe, and it's shrinking. Perhaps we should find out why. That's where our guests today come in. We have Alyssa Quart, author of Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. She's executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Alyssa, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, great to be here.
We also have Daniel Laurison, associate professor of sociology at Swarthmore College and author of Producing Politics. Daniel, it's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And for you listening at home, we want to know, what does it mean to be middle class these days? Is it about what you can afford, like home or college, or is it more about financial stability? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org. David on YouTube says, middle class is when you splurge, when your splurge is Target candles and your luxury is free shipping. Okay, so keep those comments coming. YouTube, Facebook, drop those comments in the chat.
I like that one. And so, Alyssa, we wanted to start with you because we want a baseline understanding of who and what it means to be in the middle. Can we get a definition? How much money do you make? And what does that really mean in today's terms?
So income obviously varies from region and locale, but say something like New York City or San Francisco, it could be $80,000 to $250,000 for a family of four. It's obviously substantially lower in the middle of the country. But there's other ways that we can think about it. We can think of it in terms of home ownership, financial security, which means paying your bills on time and covering emergencies, being able to afford, you know, regular home maintenance, and having retirement and college savings. And I think college savings is a big part of this.
Alyssa, is there a definition you lean toward? You think that's the most accurate, like it most accurately captures what we are thinking of when we think middle class?
I think it's being able to not live paycheck to paycheck and to also have, it is income, but it's also more existential. It's having a sense of the narrative of your life. And that's what I wrote in my book, Squeezed, which was about something I call the middle precariat. What I mean by that is the way the middle class has become precarious and more like the working class in terms of insecurity all the time. And I think that not feeling insecure all the time, to me, means that you're middle class.
Yeah. And Daniel, we want to bring you into the conversation. At the setup of the show, I talked about like how we had this dream, you know, growing up, you thought if I do all the right things, this will be the middle. I'll at least make it here to the middle class. How has that sort of shifted the idea of what we as Americans thought the middle class was or is?
mean, I think one challenge with the term, not to be an academic, but I am an academic.
Be an academic.
Be an academic. Nerd out, please.
Is that, you know, different people mean really different things by middle class. In all, even the same person might mean something different in a different conversation, right? So when the New York Times talks about working class voters, they just mean anybody without a college degree. That's two-thirds, 60% of people in this country. That would imply the rest of us are middle class, right, if we have the college degree. That's a smaller set than the set in the income band that's defined by the Pew study or that that Alyssa might use. So, you know, who means what by middle class is maybe the first question to answer.
So help us answer
help us parse
it.
That, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So I think, you know, one way to think about it is certainly income. But I think if you just do income, you miss a lot of what makes people's lives financially stable or comfortable, which is wealth. And so, you know, if you're from a family that has wealth and can help you buy that first home, can help you with your kids' college savings fund, you know, can help you if you hit a troubled spot and lose a job for a little while, you're going to feel much more financially secure than if you don't have that kind of wealth in your family. So I think wealth goes into it. I'd also say, you know, a lot of people think of occupation as the sort of key thing for class. Do you have a job where you have some autonomy? Do you have some control over what you do on a day-to-day basis? You know, or are you somebody reporting to somebody else? Are you working with your hands? Those kinds of things also go into how people talk about or think about what it means to be working class or middle class.
Middle class, yeah.
Why do we care so much, I think, in this country? Well, maybe we don't, but do you think we care a lot in this country about reaching the middle class, like more maybe than other countries? And if so, why? Like if it is more emphasized in America than elsewhere, why would it be so?
I mean, one part of it is almost certainly the how bad it is to not be middle class in this country, mm-hmm. right? So other countries have social safety nets. A friend of mine, Jessica Larco, quips based on a book she wrote recently, you know, other countries have social safety nets. We have women in this mm-hmm. country who take on a lot of the caring and a lot of the support of elders, of children outside of government provision of things like childcare or, you know, basic income or those sorts of things. So I think that's one part of it.
Escaping that is
really important. And it's not that it's not challenging to have less resources somewhere else, but you're much less likely to be worried about, will I be able to eat tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Will I have a house over my head, you know, a roof over my head? What will I be able to you know, we'll be able to feed my family, et cetera, if you're in a place with a social safety net. So I think that's at least part of why it feels so important.
Yeah, and I think about this, Alyssa, that, you know, people who we probably know that make, quote, good money, right? That, you know, 20 years ago, your parents would be like, oh, no, you're making way more than your parents did, but it doesn't feel like it. Like the security that you maybe you can't afford a house, maybe you can't do this thing, but it seems like you should be middle class, but you don't feel middle class. Can you talk about that and why there's this, you can have what it looks like on paper to be in the middle class, but it doesn't feel like that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is things like, yeah, exactly, Terry, like middle class erosion that's structural. It's stagnating wages. It's costs soaring. It's safety nets that are fraying. And now in the Trump administration 2.0, it's federal workers being laid off. It's research being defunded. It's universities. You just mentioned University of Pennsylvania being destabilized and professors no longer getting you know, money again for research or, you know, losing their jobs. And that's a standard middle-class profession. It's journalists, like the people I work with at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, who used to have jobs at newspapers, who now are independent reporters, you know, working assignment to assignment for $500 at most. And so they call themselves middle-class probably, but they're living in a universe where they're being squeezed on every side. And I think one of the things that was interesting that Daniel just said was the shame or the fear of not being middle class. And I think that has to do with what I call, you know, the bootstraps myth, mm-hmm. pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that people blame themselves if they are not solvent and in the middle and don't demand systemic fixes to the degree that they should. And there isn't a lot of dignity and solidarity if you're not in the middle class. So they'll feel a sense of self-punishment if they're not middle class. So they'll do anything to call themselves that. And I think that was why It's something like 54% of people still call themselves middle class, even though they really aren't. And it used to be 65%. This is according to a Pew study that called themselves middle class. People desperate are to name themselves that so they don't have to blame themselves.
By the way, we're asking you this hour, what does it mean to be middle class these days? Is it about what you can afford, home, college, etc.? Or is it more about financial stability or maybe a third thing we haven't even listed off there? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Ellen says, here's an example. Jersey Shore, where working class families who saved some money used to be able to buy a modest vacation house. Now those houses are teardowns to make way for as much mansion as can be squeezed onto the lot. I'm curious, that's an interesting example, Daniel, because I guess it looks at a specific commodity, vacation home, and says this means middle class. But things fluctuate in value over time. So real estate might be very expensive today, but there are other things that used to be very expensive that are far cheaper now in relative dollars. And it's sort of the question that comes to mind for me is, when it comes to what we can afford, is there something that we should think of as a stable marker of the middle class? Should always be attainable if you are in the middle class? Or is it okay for those things to fluctuate over time based on the scarcity of that particular product?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I would ask the question slightly differently, okay. which is why do people think of themselves as middle class, and how do people sort of think of themselves as having made it or having been successful, right? And that's always going to be comparative. It's always going to be based on looking around and seeing who has what near you, and also right. what you used to be able to get and can't, or what your parents could get and you can't. So I'm not sure. I mean, it could be an interesting exercise, right, to sit down and say, you are middle class if, and that's what that Washington Post article you cited does, right? This is the things people think are required to be middle class. But a feature of the way social class works in the U.S. is, A, we don't talk about it nearly as much as we ought to, mm-hmm. or money, how much we make, any of that. And so, as Alyssa was saying, there's that shame or there's that worry, and there's also just this... We don't know where we are relative to other people very well. And another feature of that is we make social comparisons with the people who are closest to us. So that means both that people who are fairly financially struggling may think they're roughly in the middle because they're in the middle of the people around them, mm-hmm. and people who are absolutely not in any reasonable definition of the middle class, people making $250,000 or in households making $250,000, $300,000 a year, top 90-95% of the income distribution, are spending time with people making $600,000 or seven figures or more, and so feeling like they're in the middle relative to
the people
around
them. So in that whole morass, we have to try to have a somewhat of a stable conversation about what actually is and if it's getting smaller. So Alyssa, you said you focus more less on income and more on sort of that wealth and security part of it. So like what would you point us to say it's changing or it's not changing over time?
Well, I mean, we can look at things like the cost of college. That's something that that tripled or quadrupled, not in relation to inflation over a 20 or 30 year period. Part of why I'm saying college is because that's what politicians often cite. Like, this is how you can get yourself into the middle class. This is how you can get the American dream by being college educated. And that might be out of reach. Or again, with the home ownership. And I think the costs of housing and renting have skyrocketed in major American cities. And again, that becomes a marker of being middle class. But I do think things like not being part of a gig economy, and that is where we have the middle precariat. We have people, working software jobs almost in a gig way. We have people working academic jobs in a gig way. We have people, journalists, and et cetera. And so I think not having that kind of permanence of an identity is not really fully being middle class.
Yeah. And that's growing. You're saying that part of the labor market's growing.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to remind folks that you can participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is, what do you think it means to be middle class these days? Is it about what you can afford, or is it about financial stability or something else? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments coming in the chat. We have a caller. Kelly from Ardmore is on the line. Kelly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. How are you? My comment is that the idea of middle class is unattainable on all the levels that you mentioned, meaning just being able to afford life, the wealth, going away for a weekend. It's like unattainable. Even if you're someone like me, I have a steady job. I have a PhD. I work in academia, but I can't survive unless I work a part-time job. So there is no joy, meaning being able to go to a movie or taking a day off or taking a weekend away. It's just not attainable anymore.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Kelly from Ardmore. And I wonder, you know, Daniel, and then Alyssa would love to hear a comment on this as well. I think back to the way my mom and dad and my grandmother grew up, right? They worked. My grandmother was a teacher. They owned a home, but they didn't have all the fancy stuff that we have now. They didn't have $1,000, you know, phones in their pockets. The cars were, you know, they had one car for the house, not multiple cars. They're not multiple televisions in the house. So I just wonder, has our standard of living and like gone up so high to where what it means to be middle class has sort of shifted to where it is unaffordable? And I just ask, it was a much more simpler life, I guess, 30, 40 years ago. Yes?
I mean, I think that when you think about the consumer goods we have, in many ways we have many very nice things that we didn't used to have, many of us, right? So that is absolutely true, and it's lovely. I like my phone. I don't have that many TVs, but I like the stuff I've got. But I think what's happened at least over the last 50, 75 years is the amount of nice technology that's available to us has been increasing pretty steadily, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense as a cause for people to feel less financially stable, right? Mm-hmm. You buy a phone once every, hopefully not more than 2 or 3 years. You buy, you know, your TVs once. That's not making people feel like they can't, that they're, as Alyssa was saying, that they're worried about making their rent, or they're worried about, or they're not able to buy a home, or they're not able to afford college for their kids.
But it is an added monthly expense that maybe you didn't have 40, 50 years ago, you know, and there's all these added monthly expenses that you may not have had to worry about.
Yeah, I think that's true, but the overall squeeze and also the overall level of inequality that's gone up is sort of beyond the scope of those sorts of bills. I mean, I haven't sat down and done the math about those costs and so on, but I'm pretty confident about this. In the 70s through even the early 80s, the top 1% had less than roughly less than 10% of the total income. Now they have over 25% of the total income. So the scope of inequality is really, I think, what's making people feel squeezed, and the rise in some really key expenses much more than your monthly phone bill or that sort of thing.
Yeah. And Alyssa, would love to get your thoughts on that. And then add to the fact that, you know, according to data in 1992, there were 88,000 households worth $20 million or more. And in 2022, that number was 644,000 households. So there's more people who are very affluent, and there's more people falling into the working class or the lower class. But then, you know, the squeeze is going on in the middle class. What do you think is the squeeze?
Well, I mean, what Daniel said is absolutely true, that there's both real costs that have gone up, and then there's things that we want now. You know, my kid wants a new phone every 6 months, you know, and this is, and I start to sound like my mother. I'm like, what? Why do you even need one to begin with, right?
Why do you even need a Discman? Yeah.
Discman. Yeah, no, more like Walkman. Thank you very much. But, you know, but I also think there are things like, you know, inflation and rising rents making the pleasures of middle class life out of reach, like mm-hmm. dinners out, or theater. Fewer vacation times structured into people's work lives. So this is what the caller was just talking about pleasures for the middle class also being squeezed, and that is a way to think of it. Plus things like, if you have kids, summer camps are now insane. Has anyone felt this? I went to summer camp. It wasn't, you know, my parents were, you know, taught community college. Now it's like it was like $4,000 for a week and a half, like some insane, and that's just the expectation. And then things like, you know, fuel and power are more expensive as, politicians declare war on renewables. deportations, threats to immigrants now threaten the agriculture sector, but also daycare and domestic work that will eventually make these services go from barely affordable to unaffordable. Increasing consolidation of industries makes services more expensive. And then like chocolate and coffee because of climate change, you know, it just starts to feel like a level of insecurity on so many fronts. I call it economic plus. It's not just about money. It's about insecurity in terms of climate change. It's about insecurity in terms of information. Are we getting accurate information? How to get accurate, you know, that is also mystifying what it means to be middle class or even feel safe in America.
Yeah. Let me bring in another caller. This is Liz from Chestnut Hill on line two. And by the way, reminder, this hour we're asking you, what do you think it means to be middle class these days? Is it about what you can afford, home, college, more about financial stability, something else? Liz, are you have an answer to that question for us?
Well, I don't know that it's an answer, but I always come to home ownership, not only because you need a place to live, but owning a home builds wealth. And my husband and I were able to send our kids to college because our house was basically our ATM. Mm. And, you know, I that's mobility. And so, yeah, I always go to home ownership.
It's really an interesting point that Liz makes because of all the things we're talking about here, can you afford this? Can you afford that? Almost none of them appreciate in value, but a home does. And that unlocks a whole world when you have an asset that's going to be worth more in 15 years than it's worth now. I was doing some research for the show, Daniel, and I was actually kind of surprised looking at home ownership rates in the U.S. I thought they would have fallen. They really haven't since the 70s. In fact, from the 70s to like the early 2000s, they rose quite dramatically. Dramatically within a range, and they fell a little bit after the housing crisis. Then they bounced back up. I guess there's lots of ways to measure home ownership rates, but this is the standard that the Fed uses. Is that one of the things that's becoming more elusive? Is it adding to this idea that people feel like they're not in the middle class anymore? Where does home ownership fit into this whole equation for you?
Yeah, so I haven't looked at those stats that you just mentioned, but I do know that the median age of a first-time homeowner has gone up substantially over the last 10 years. So it may be that the same portion of people own homes, but the people who are doing it are older overall. And so that feels like a squeeze if you're 30 and you're, you know, just starting out, 25 or 30, just starting out, maybe with some new kids, and you're not able to be a homeowner.
And you're not building that wealth earlier in your life.
Exactly. So I think that's certainly part of it.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, a lot of those people are cash poor and home rich in the sense that they're, you know, in serious debt. So I think we have, I would love to look at those numbers and see, are we talking about people with 30-year mortgages or are we talking about people who own their homes outright? And I think we have to talk here also about race, you know, who got to inherit their parents' homes. And indeed, we have to talk about the history of inequity in this country in terms of home ownership.
And that's one of the topics we'll talk to on the other side of the break. By the way, Jeff says social comparisons and the desire to be middle class can be an illusion because families are in excessive amounts of debt in order to keep up appearances. And that's Jeff talking about this online. Jeff also says being in the middle class means simply having all the things you need and some of the things you want. That's Jeff's definition of what it means to be in middle class.
I don't need you to keep calling and commenting, but I want you to. What does it mean to be middle class these days? Is it about what you can afford, like home or college? Or is it more to you about financial stability or maybe something else? Keep those calls coming. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Hey, drop a comment in the chat. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We are looking today at the eroding middle class, the impact on our country when a middle class life is no longer attainable for many people. Let's reintroduce our guest. Daniel Lorison is an associate professor of sociology at Swarthmore College. And Alyssa Quart is executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and author of Bootstrapped, liberating ourselves from the American dream.
And we invite you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, to participate. The question of the day is, what does it mean to be middle class today? Is it about what you can afford, like home or college, or is it more about financial stability, or is it something else? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. And Candace on YouTube says, we had three children to put through college, own our home, cars, insurance for the kids in another state, maybe things would look better. The taxation in New Jersey, she's talking about property tax and insurance, makes it hard. None Your Business on YouTube says, mobile phones and multiple vehicles are not luxuries, but necessities in this modern age, especially in the U.S. without public transportation and both partners working outside the home. So those are the comments we've received on YouTube. Yeah, people feeling it.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Tracy from Doylestown on the line, I think, with a question for us. Tracy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question?
You know, as I listen to this discussion, I think that I don't think about class in any of these terms. I think of it in terms of taste and sensibilities and how we enjoy, you know, our education and how we, you know, live our lives. You know, what we can appreciate and live kind of, we can appreciate a high style life without actually living one, you know, in terms of what we do and how we think. I'd like to get feedback on why class always has to be talked about in terms of money.
Yeah. Thank you. That's Tracy.
What do you think about that, Daniel? That's an interesting perspective. Honestly, had not occurred to me before the show. Liberating class from wealth on some level. Is that a current we see through American society, other societies? Just some general thoughts on that call, Daniel.
Yeah, I think this is part of why terms like middle class are so complicated and contested, right? And part of why, you know, a lot of people, when they say middle class, they mean normal people like me in some way,
yeah,
right? Not like me personally, but it just means like a regular person. That's, you know, so that's one way of using it. And I think it becomes a very political term. And one that also often has sort of, you know, overtones of living in the suburbs or being white or, you know, a lot of things we think sort of go along with that, which is really different than the economic version, which is all, you know, the sort of purely income version, which is also really different from the taste version. You know, there's a theorist I really like called Pierre Bourdieu who talks about the idea of cultural capital, right? The idea that knowing how to behave in certain circumstances, being comfortable in certain sort of high status places, going to art museums, going to the symphony, for a couple of really easy examples, are part of the kind of resource that gets you other advantages in life, right? If you can be comfortable at a dinner in a fancy restaurant at a job interview, you're more likely to get that job. So taste in that sense for him is part of class, right? Like if you're comfortable with high status tastes, you're going to be have advantages. And then there are people who absolutely think of class as just your tastes, right? Are you sort of a high class person who knows how to wear the right clothes or say the right words or that sort of thing? I think, you know, for me as a sociologist, it's really important to be careful in what we, you know, when we use a class term, to be really clear about what we mean by it. So again, to be an annoying academic, but that is my
that's
job.
Your role today.
Yes.
Don't shy away from that.
Yes. Lean in. Yeah. Lean in, Daniel. By the way, I wanted to shift back to the who is in the middle class with you, Alyssa, because you mentioned that race as an issue, but also gender can sort of determine whether or not you make it into this middle class area or even make it outside of the middle class, right, to affluence where people are trying to aim. And so can you talk about that? What do the numbers say as far as who gets to that type of mobility and land in the middle class?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that, for instance, motherhood is a disadvantage for employees, that the mothers earn on average something like $11,000 less than their colleagues, female colleagues without children. So even just even within our gender as women, if you have a kid, you're going to be earning less. And that's the ways that which people will be delegating and giving you hiring you at lower rates. I mean, I wanted also to go back to the distinctions. That's Pierre Bourdieu's famous book, Distinctions, about taste. And I think one thing is, one way I see this is Barbara Ehrenreich, who was a great writer and my colleague, who I started the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with, said that class is a common relation to the economic foundations of society, but it's actually about relations between groups of people, not formal relations, but between groups of people and between objects. And so I think we could, that definition now combines all three. So it's the relation to the economic foundations of society, but actually between people and also between objects.
Like maybe along the lines of something that Chloe was talking about earlier, people like to pretend that class isn't a thing in America compared to other countries, but we're constantly being judged by what class we are in based on what we wear, the car we drive, vacations, house, and now with social media, it's even worse, talking about the culture of comparison. I want to bring in another caller now. This is Rebecca from Northern Liberties, and based on the little tease we have here, I'm very interested to hear what Rebecca has to say. Hey, Rebecca, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So from my perspective, and I'm 75, I have two daughters who are in their 30s, so they're, you know, they're in starting in the beginning and the middle of their careers. It seems to me that what really drives this is the big things that we need, whether that's housing or college, particularly. But the other thing that I think is missing is the issue of time, and particularly for one thing, it do you have two breadwinners in the house instead of just one, the way it was once upon a time? Do you maybe have two breadwinners with four jobs? Maybe you have a job, but you have to work 80 hours a week. I think that leaves a lot less time to do those other things, whether they cost money or not.
Free time, and also, leisure course, time,
right. And of course, you also are not able to spend the money that might buy you time, like to have someone to clean your house or to do other things for you. So I think that's another squeeze that people are feeling. Especially if they feel like they have to work two jobs in order to get that place to live to go to college or whatever.
A great comment from Rebecca, and Trevor sent us an email along similar lines. What makes someone middle class is agency over their free time plus property ownership while still being a 9-to-5 employee. This has changed over time. In the 50s, one could work on a shop floor in manufacturing, still have leisure time, safe retirement while owning a home. That idea of time, I feel like gets back to something you were talking about earlier, Alyssa, like it's about stability, certainty. If I know I'm working in these hours and those other hours are reserved for me and my family to enjoy, to be together, I feel like I have something really, really precious. And I'm curious how our time has changed over time. Do you have any insights on that, Alyssa?
Well, yeah, I mean, we are called upon by social media and emails and employers to be, available at odd hours, on weekends. This is like a norm now. And this also applies to the middle class. It means that you're potentially also doing side hustles. I wrote about this in my book, Squeezed, about teachers in California who didn't earn enough in these sort of like San Jose, San Francisco kind of areas because it was so expensive, and they had to drive Uber on the weekends. So there's also the time squeeze of having to have a second job in order to maintain a middle class. This is just in terms of
You know what's so ironic about that too is that you bring up Uber. That's such an interesting one, right? Because Uber driving is made possible by car ownership, which has increased. More people own cars or two cars than they did 50 years ago. And the phone ownership. And both of those things are supposed to make your life more efficient and more convenient. We're able to buy these things, and that's their explicit purpose. And yet they have now sucked us into this second job that we need in order to afford them. I mean, it just seems... Yeah. It seems like a trap. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a complete trap. And I mean, I just was, I ran a conference recently at Columbia Journalism School where one of the speakers was telling a story about what Uber does to try to get drivers to do that last drive. It will like find out where they are at, and suggest a drive that's just a couple miles away from their home to keep them working. So, I mean, we haven't even talked about AI, which is another AI and all these surveillance, labor surveillance elements that are going to be keeping us working in even weirder ways. Yeah. I mean, so something like AI seems to have siphoned off something like $14 billion from the media industry, which is the industry I'm in. And that is also going to be destabilizing who gets to be middle class and to control their own time.
Yeah. A lot of the jobs and for those people working in the middle class are going to be impacted by AI. You wanted to say something,
yeah,
Daniel?
I think when you put it as, you know, we have trapped ourselves by these consumer products, though, you miss something that's, I think, really important, which is the policies and laws that shape the incomes and the opportunities that we have.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could get rid of my phone, and we only have one car, but I could get rid of that too, and then I'd be stuck on the public transit that is getting cut radically in Philadelphia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, doing that wouldn't change how much teachers are making in San Jose and whether they can afford a home there, right? And those kinds of things are the result of political decisions that we make as a country. And so I think that, you know, I hear what you're saying, and we could always think about whether we might want to have less stuff. But I think when we put it on consumer choices, we miss the larger.
I was saying the opposite.
Yeah.
You have to own those things
in order to have a decent life.
And then
yeah.
you by virtue of owning these things that are supposed to make your life more convenient, you actually end up with less leisure time. And so I'm with you on that. Go ahead.
And by the way, Carmen from Lancaster had a question. Carmen says, how are people defining people who are not middle class? Are they working class? What are they? And Alyssa, if you could weigh in on that, because, you know, we're trying to say who's in the middle based on what, but what makes someone not in the middle?
Well, I mean, again, that's another, I'm sure Daniel will have lots of declensions, like lots of different definitions of that. But I'd say, I don't know, maybe it's, again, related to education levels. Do you have secondary, college education, graduate? Are you doing manual work? You know, some of the ways that we define working class would be by that. And sometimes it's by things that I find very unappealing, like the definition unskilled labor, which I don't think should exist, because anybody who's ever tried to make a pizza or
it's a skill.
Find their way around a department store's lingerie section knows that it's not, you can't be unskilled. So I just, that is one of the ways that people describe lower wage work or working class work as unskilled, as not having higher education levels. And then maybe sometimes it's monetary, it could be like 50,000 and below, but again, it depends on like geography, 60,000 below. But you know, automobile workers, would you define them as middle class or working class if they're making $80,000? You know what I mean? How would you talk about a contractor or plumber?
Yeah.
So that's where it gets kind of complicated.
Yeah. I wonder if you had any thing, if you wanted to weigh in on that, Daniel, but also talk policy and solutions for sort of shoring up the middle class.
Yeah, I guess I'll say two things. One about definitions. I mean, I think what I think we mean in this conversation when we say middle class is really like having some basic financial security, having some basic free time. That's the vision that we all sort of seem to share. And that does require a certain income threshold or a certain, and then it's more likely if you have certain kinds of jobs or if you have family wealth, et cetera, et cetera. But again, I think it's clearer to say financial security or not financial security rather than middle class or not middle class. I don't love the term just in general for that reason, because I think it obscures more than it clarifies.
Yeah, and if you were to bring in a policy that you think could make the middle class stronger, what would that be?
I mean, anything to reduce income inequality, right? Anything to have higher taxes on the better off, anything to give more support to people at the bottom end of the income distribution. We could make college more affordable or free. We could make homeownership much, much easier and support it more. You know, there's tons of policies, and they're all, none of them are rocket science. They're just fundamentally about being willing to say it doesn't make sense to have some people with billions and billions of dollars and very little contribution and other people starving on the street.
Well, we will leave it there, and we will thank our great guest today. You just heard there from Daniel Lorison, associate professor of sociology at Swarthmore College and author of Producing Politics. Daniel, thanks. What did you just call yourself? Something academic?
Annoying academic.
Thanks for being our annoying academic, Daniel. And also thank you, Alyssa Court, author of Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream, and executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Alyssa, thank you for your time today on Studio 2.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be here.
And now it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Hit it, Al.
Life is unfair, so I just stare at the...
That is Boss of Me by They Might Be Giants from 1999. Great choice. It was the theme song from Malcolm in the Middle, the show on Fox. Thank you to Buggy on YouTube for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day.
Yes, shout out to Buggy. And by the way, shout out to our producers who help us get through everything. Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer. Thanks to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. Also want to thank Rita from Cinnamon Sin and Tina from Doylestown College we didn't get to today, and all the great commenters. I have to say, I never knew there was another part of this song that wasn't in the intro from Malcolm in the Middle.
Well,
this is blowing my mind right now.
Every day.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. We're going to hear the rest of this song as we go out today. Thank you for joining us. We will talk to you next week. No, can you-